Hello and welcome to this week's Radio Dialect. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to you in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world accessing the show on the internet. We have this week Andrew Baisley, a blues guitarist, and Alastair Parks will be talking about the current exhibition, Metamarine, which is at the Grant Bradley Gallery in Bedminster. We have a feature from Anthea Page, an interview with Deborah Hearn, a project worker at the BBC Learning Services, a BBC writing competition to be launched this month. Malcolm Greaves reads another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire between 1820 and 1830, and Jeff Sparks rounds the show up with his latest What's On. I'm Lisa Braden, presenter of this week's show. Our next guest is local blues musician Andrew Baisley. Hello Andrew, and welcome to Radio Dialect.
Hello, thanks very much.
Tell me about your music.
Oh, my music. Gosh, well, how long have you got?
About 10 minutes.
My music goes back about 200 years. People think blues is a modern thing.
I thought you said you retired, not that
Very nearly, yeah. This is my sort of paid hobby in my retirement, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the music is, I mean, what I play is the really old blues, which goes back sort of mid-1920s when it first started being recorded. Beyond that, we don't know much about it because it wasn't recorded. But most of my songs are from that kind of period. And I try and play them the way they would have played them then, as far as we know.
What got you into blues in the first place?
I heard it, I think I must have been about 12. And I'd listened to foreign radio stations late at night. And there was an American station, AFN, American Forces Network. And there was a French station. And they played programmes that just had old, what we called country blues songs. I was just hooked on it and I just wanted to play it and wanted to hear more of it way back then.
So where are you from originally?
Well, I was born in the Midlands, but I grew up in East Anglia in Suffolk. And then I moved down to Bath to go to college in Bath. And I've been in the West Country ever since, in and around Bath. And I live in Bradford-on-Avon now, so just the other side of Bath.
What did you study at Bath?
I trained to be a teacher. Never did it. But, you know, I don't think my heart was in it, really.
So. Music teacher?
No. Primary school teacher, teaching English and that sort of thing. But music was always going on. I think that's why my heart wasn't in it, really. It was, you know, I'd like teaching to have been a hobby and music to have been the job, really, but didn't work out that way.
So you're a full-time musician now around Bristol?
No. I sort of retired from my main job about 5 years ago.
Which was?
Do you really want to know?
I think so.
I was a bank manager.
Were you?
I was a bank manager, it can be told.
Right, and, this is going out on the air, you know that.
I know, that's why I wasn't very keen.
Okay.
And I was 28 years doing that. And luckily I did the music at the same time, so I could just about put up with it for 28 years. And then they got rid of me and gave me a pension, and I work for Wiltshire County Council now, part-time, which gives me time to do the music properly.
So what venues do you play at now? I
used to play the Old Duke when I had a band. I had a little band called Barrel House Blues. We used to play there for about 5 years. But we split up about 2 years ago. And I play mostly, because I live in Bradford-on-Avon, I play mostly over that way now, sort of Wiltshire. Last weekend I was in Swanage. I had 3 gigs in Swanage last weekend. And I've been over to Suffolk. So I get around a bit, but it's mostly sort of Wiltshire. A few in Bath. I got one in Bristol in November.
And where would that be? What venue?
That's at the Hare on the Hill in...
Is that...
Kingsdown. Kingsdown,
oh, is that St Michael's Hill?
It's somewhere, right? Yeah, not quite that far up. And that's the 22nd of November. And right. I've got one in Bath on the 8th of October. Mm-hmm. And then this coming Saturday, I'm in Chippenham at the Old Road. So those are the next three. And I've got to have an operation on my shoulder, so I've got a bit of a break. Well, that sorts itself out. So,
I understand you're going to play a couple of songs for us.
Well, I'll play at least one. I can either stretch one out or do two. Whatever you got time for.
We've got time for two.
Have you? Yes. Okay, well, I'll do two then.
Go ahead, Andrew Baisley.
Thank you. If I was asked to pick any song that kind of typified the old Delta Blues style, it would be this one. It's a Robert Johnson song. It's called If I Had Possession Over Judgment Day.
If I had possession over
for Judgment Day. If I had possession of a Judgment Day, that woman I'm loving, she had no right to pray. You know, I went to the mountain, far as the eye could see. Said I went to the mountain, far as the eye could see. Some man got my woman, and the lonesome blues have got me. I folded my arms and I slowly walked away. I said I folded my arms and I slowly walked away. I said, bye bye darling, I'm gonna see you Judgment Day. And now I rode and I tumbled and I cried the whole night long. I said I rode and I tumbled and I cried the whole night long. I woke up this morning, everything I had was gone. Quite a famous blues song. It's called the Diving Duck Blues. It's normally done very fast, but a lot of blues songs, you really get the essence out of them if you slow them down a bit. So that's what I've done with this one, Diving Duck Blues.
If the river was whiskey, I was a diving duck. If the river was whiskey, I was a diving duck. I'd dive to the bottom and I'd never come home. Take all your money and give it to another man. A married woman has always been my crave. A married woman has always been my crave. A married woman gonna take me to my grave. Thank you. sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. The sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. And the wind's gonna rise and blow all these blues away. I'm going to the railroad, gonna look up to the sun. I'm going to the railroad, gonna look up to the sun. And if a train don't come soon, gonna get some walking done. If the river was whiskey, I was a diving duck. If the river was whiskey, I was a diving duck. I'd dive to the bottom and I'd never come home.
I was talking there to blues musician Andrew Baisley. His website is www.andrewbaisley.com. Thank you very much for coming in and entertaining us.
Thank you,
I've
enjoyed it.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Our next guest is Alistair Park. He's here to talk about the Metamarine exhibition at the Grant Bradley Gallery in Bedminster. The exhibition has been described as a collision of the Natural History Museum and the Art Gallery in a display of new work, plunging into the underwater world of oceans, real and imaginary, that may sometimes shock, hopefully delight, but would certainly surprise. Welcome, Alistair. I must apologise for my husky voice.
Hello.
Would you like to tell us about your involvement in the exhibition?
Yeah, well, last year I organised an exhibition at the Centre Space Gallery in the middle of town, and we had such a good time doing it, and we had such a good response that we decided to do it again this year. There was about 700 people came, and 8 of the people who showed last year ended up showing at Bristol Museum. So it went really well. And then Banksy must have heard about it and had the same idea.
Right, I understand there's a fabric turtle feast.
There's all sorts of stuff. There's going to be some very off-the-wall stuff. But everybody who's exhibiting is a professional at what they do or is skilled, very skilled. So it's all very high-quality stuff. And I would say fairly accessible. There's some good ideas, but it's not the sort of stuff that you'd look at and go, what does that mean?
And how did you get involved with this?
Well, I organised the last one. And I wanted to do a show and looked around for the people that I thought were doing good enough work to show with, the people that I wanted to show with. And so everybody is pretty good, I'd say. Very good.
And what's you'll be exhibiting?
I'm going to be exhibiting, it's kind of hard to describe really. It's about a foot long. It's made out of hundreds of pieces of wood. It's an imaginary creature, hunting creature, that you'd need to see, really. It's very hard to describe.
And how long is the exhibition on for?
It's going to be on from the 7th of October to the 31st of October.
Is it free to get in?
It's free admission, and it's at the Grant Bradley Gallery, which is next to the Big Asda in Bedminster.
Right. So what are you hoping to get from the exhibition?
Well, it'd be nice to show at the museum again, but really, it's just great showing. They're a great group of people to work with. We all have a lot of fun, and who knows? Just see what happens, see who comes along and see what happens afterwards.
What inspires you?
What inspires me? Mm-hmm. Well, this particular piece was inspired by a book by a guy called Stephen Jay Gould called Wonderful Life, which is all about creatures that they found as fossils. And he realised that they're so diverse and so strange that it's only a quirk of fate that the animals that evolved into modern animals did. It could have been anything. We could be walking around in a world that's completely strange and alien to us. So basically, I was thinking about other ways of evolution. Things could have developed in different ways. So I created my own creature in my head and then made it out of wood.
Right. What other pieces have you got?
In the show?
Yeah.
Oh, just that one.
Just that one.
No, I'm just showing one. But some people are making hats out of origami. Some people are making all sorts, sailing ships with strange cargoes inside them. Film posters for monster movies from the 50s that never got made. Gigantic mermaid's purses. All sorts of stuff. All kinds of wacky things.
So it's got the very, very nautical theme.
It's going to be, well, it's all around the sea, hence the name Metamarine. It's all based on things to do with the sea. But it's, yeah, it's a very, very diverse show. It would be impossible to tell you exactly what it's all about because everybody's, there's 13 people showing and everybody's coming at it from a different angle.
Have you got a favourite piece of someone else's?
I haven't seen most of them yet, so I couldn't possibly answer that.
Right. Would you like to give details of your website and how to get in contact with you?
Well, my own website is www.carvings-with-stories.co.uk, and there'll be information about the Metamarine show on that.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Alistair Park, for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We hear a song now from the Red Notes Choir based in St Werburgh's. The Red Notes Choir campaigns for peace, justice, freedom and internationalism and was first formed in 2002. This song is called Rumbala, about the Spanish Civil War which devastated Spain from July 1936 and ended in April 1939, 70 years ago.
Viva la quince brigada,
rumbala, rumbala, rumbala.
Viva la quince brigada,
rumbala, rumbala, rumbala.
Que se aquieto de gloria, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Que se aquieto de gloria, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Luchamos contra racistas,
rumbala, rumbala, rumbala.
Luchamos contra racistas,
rumbala, rumbala, rumbala.
Mercenarios y fascistas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Mercenarios y fascistas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela.
Solo es nuestro deseo, rumbala, rumbala, rumbala. Solo es nuestro deseo, rumbala, rumbala, rumbala. Acabar con el fascismo, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Acabar con el fascismo, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. En el frente de Jarama,
rumbala, rumbala, rumbala.
En el frente de Jarama,
rumbala, rumbala, rumbala.
No tenemos ni aviones ni tanques ni cañones, ay Carmela. No tenemos ni aviones ni tanques ni cañones, ay Carmela.
Ya salimos de España, rumbala, rumbala, rumbala. Ya salimos de España, rumbala, rumbala, rumbala. O luchar en otros frentes, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. O luchar en otros frentes, ay Carmela, ay Carmela.
That was the Red Notes Choir singing a song called Rumbala about the Spanish Civil War. It's now time for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves, a story set in Oxfordshire between 1820 and 1830. In 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Thame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Naval Volunteer Pub in Bristol.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. C. E. Bennett, K.C., now judge, has just left after being with us for 3 weeks, standing and failing as Liberal candidate. Huge mass of kindness, integrity, enthusiasm and laughter. The chief obsessions of our Liberals here are ham, tea and local option. I couldn't think that Bennett would plump his full, rugged soul for any of these things. Though he did, and for a time at least, this place is safe for him with his bottle of Chateau Latour. I would like to know if it increases the value of a town to have merely its name better known. For how many thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, now for the first time know of this place, either through coming here, or being told of it, or through reading about the place in books and papers. Being 8th week, we had 88 to dinner, besides our house party, 99 in all. I didn't expect more than 40, so that while serving the meal, I had to prepare another. People often ask if it isn't difficult to cope, if you don't know how many people you'll have to feed. And before taking it in, I used to bother over this problem with hypothetical cases. But in practice, it doesn't trouble one. True, sometimes almost all you have is your brains to put in the pots and pans for people to eat. Leslie Crawshay Williams, whom for his notorious honesty I'm proud to own as a cousin, at least the Crawshay part, brought Son Rupert and Mona Stewart and others. Mona is so attractive that I can believe the tale that she's had 13 proposals, with her black hair, white face and drunken eyes. It's rather horrible that those who used to come so often in our quiet days come again now, and I can see so little of them, busy in the kitchen doing the work of rotten cooks. We've given, with 3 parlourmaids, 240 meals today, and not a bloke has waited more than digestion requires. Jock Lemaitre, who smiles attendance on the First Lord of the Admiralty, Douglas Payton, kind Scot of 6'8", W. Waldorf Astor, Donald Lennox Boyd, the maddest of his brothers 4, Nigel Sly, De Candolle with flashing teeth, Alan Bicknell, nephew, a droll, and of couples, some of our best, the Hugo Pittmans, the Guy Vaughan Morgans, Lawford and Eldred Kerwin, the Ian Forbes Lees, and the Peter Cleggs. At dinner, someone wanted the cognac left on the table and disputed Katie's computation, who deducted the 3 shillings. Moral: if you want a yard of calico, cut it off the roll yourself. I may be hopelessly neurotic, but when I object to this or that person or class of persons in the place, I get no sympathy often from the very people for whom I keep this place and who like it most. They say, why shouldn't they drink whiskey or beer at dinner? Why don't you have a girl in the bar who can make proper cocktails? You can't have everyone highbrows. Personally, I like to see all sorts of people. It's amusing. Doesn't the law compel you to give beer and food to everyone who asks for it? Why shouldn't the undergraduate make a noise? He's young. And so on. But if all these types came in their numbers, my ungracious critics wouldn't come themselves anymore. The atmosphere would change. I should take no active part in it. I have found that the person who comes all the way here and drinks beer or whiskey at dinner, I accept undergraduates, of course, and a few legitimate cases, generally wants a chair and grub. I prefer the other kind of guest who says it's a shame to drink beer with this food, and with such people one hasn't even noticed that they are drinking it. Nor would one mind if they drank nothing. With good food, water runs wine very closely. So away with my friendly critics, I must paint my own picture in my own lonely way. One old man of that doubtful age between 100 and 200, who's been here grumbling, dieting, refusing and planing, all with a pleasant crocodile smile, for 14 days, moved off today. Nice Americans. So far we don't get Americans as such. Three good ones dined here from Oxford, friends of Mrs. Kenyon Cox and Mrs. Shipman, New York. It may be the German blood that makes the nice Americans so sentimental and affectionate. What makes them so calm, as if they had been landed gentry for centuries, I don't know. Save perhaps their having made enough money, and the knowledge that their businesses are sufficiently well organised to make them free from care when away from them. Anyhow, these folks exude sweetness, the little man with black specs, the thin man, and the rather beautiful woman. So does Edward P. Larrabee with his old-fashioned pose of ma'am to Kate and sir to me. He's very learned, but goes about modestly deferring to us English, as if we must be better educated than himself, in my case at least, with a little suspicion, I would think. And his little daughter Anki, a precocious mixture of Queen Victoria and tomboy. Yesterday, 10 undergraduates, ex-aesthete, now theatrical, with their long legs, lunched and then went on the switchback and spoilt the garden air by their noisy conversation. I feel de trop in a garden myself. All adults are out of place in a garden, save gardeners. After that, they monopolised with their long legs the little dining room for tea. Today, seven of the same party came and had tea again and went off without paying or saying anything. Some time afterwards I wrote to one and had no answer. And then to another. Dear Mr. S., seven of you had tea here 3 days ago and went away without paying. The incident would argue a delightfully communistic spirit amongst yourselves, in that apparently no one inquired or cared who paid for his tea, provided he didn't himself. But I cannot live on the high ideals of others. I write to you because I think you would be the most humane and respectable of the party, which very reason makes me loath to write to you. I would be very grateful to you for getting me out of this embarrassed position. No answer. But a month later, S, ever delightful, came with a vast family party, and Papa, on his own initiative, nobly paid.
Thank you, Malcolm. You can hear another instalment next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with Deborah Hearn, a project worker at the BBC Learning Centre.
My name is Deborah Hearn and I'm a project worker for BBC Learning, and I'm currently working on a project called BBC My Story.
Will this cover Bristol or the whole of the country?
BBC My Story is launching mid-September and it's a nationwide project, so it not only covers England, it covers Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. I'm not covering all of those regions. I'm working in the West Patch, so I cover Gloucester, Wiltshire, Somerset, Bristol. And there are others of me all around the country that are kind of coordinating the other bits of my story in other regions.
This is a big project. What's the idea behind it?
Well, the idea, I mean, I'm very passionate about my story, and the idea comes from everybody has a story to tell, everybody. And I've always believed that. And the BBC came up with this wonderful idea of asking people to actually write their own personal stories. So it's something that happened to them, and to write it down. 300 words is the minimum amount of words that we're looking for, up to a maximum of 1,500 words. But it's about finding those untold stories that people feel happy enough to actually write down and then send in to the BBC, which will then be put on to a BBC My Story website. So anybody, anywhere will be able to read that story.
Will there be different categories for the stories?
So the BBC is keen to capture as many different stories as possible, covering as many different kind of areas as possible. So we've come up with 13 themes. And the themes cover achievement, adventure, bravery, celebration, charity, discovery, family and friends, humour, romance, sadness, survival, the outdoors, and lastly, tragedy. So with those 13 themes, I think we can cover all bases, really.
So what about the standard of writing? Is that important?
Not really, no. The story is really important. What we want to try and do are capture stories that really have passion, that have something exciting to tell us, or maybe something that we can learn from. And the actual grammar isn't that important. Again, we want to try and encourage people that maybe lack confidence in writing or aren't particularly great in terms of literacy to actually forget about that and just have the confidence to tell their story. The grammar isn't the most important thing, the story is.
So do you think we've lost the art of storytelling?
Yes, I think we probably have. I think with obviously communication and IT and the internet, I think people are just immersed in all this kind of computer communication rather than actually face-to-face storytelling. And storytelling for me, and I'm passionate about storytelling, is that it can really educate, entertain and inform people in such a way that it can move people to sort of change maybe how the way they think. It can instill people to actually pass down stories from generation to generation. So there's historical sort of aspects to storytelling. For me, storytelling is probably one of the most powerful means of communication we have.
So the recent programme on television, Who Do You Think You Are, do you think that was quite informative about people's background?
I mean, genealogy is a fantastic way of passing down stories, because how often do we kind of know about not only our grandparents, but our great-grandparents? I bet most people we stop in the street, if you say, you know, do you know what your great-grandparents did or what they achieved or their stories? Most people say no. So often stories are lost, and I think people actually are getting much more interested in genealogy and family history now, which is a good thing, because it's keeping, I suppose, traditions and history alive within families, but not only families, but other people can share those stories and learn as well.
I understand My Story's a competition. Can you tell us what the prizes are going to be?
Yeah, actually, it is a competition. We are opening this up to anybody. So if anybody's got a story about themselves that they want to actually send in, then if it's sent into the website and then it actually is published onto the website, then automatically it will be looked at in terms of the competition. And the competition is eventually the 15 best stories will be made into BBC films, which will then be broadcast next year in 2010. So there will be three stories around five themes, totaling in 15 films. And the five best stories, the five best individual stories, those five individuals will actually receive a book deal, and they will then be turned into a book. And there is a prize associated with that.
It will have to be written in English, is that right?
Yes, we can only accept stories that are in English or Welsh. The other thing that I want to say is that you can get help. So if somebody, if you're not particularly confident and somebody has offered to write your story down for you, then that's fine. The other thing I want to mention is that the UK online centres all around the country are on board with this project. So if you haven't got access to a computer or you're not particularly confident in writing on a computer, the UK online centres can help you. We also want to make it very clear that anybody can enter this competition, and I just want to kind of emphasise the fact that we are hoping that people who haven't thought about writing stories before actually have the confidence to do this. And we are working with learning agencies, neighbourhood projects, colleges, and hopefully lots of them will come on board and help people write their stories. If you're from a family and you actually want to write a story about a family perspective, that's fine. You know, one person from the family can actually write that down. The other things that you need to bear in mind is to actually enter the competition, you have to be over the age of 18. So that's a stipulation that we've kind of put on the competition. But I'm just hoping that people will sit down and think, actually, yeah, I want people to know this about me or about my life or about my family, and have a go at writing it. In terms of the website, we are launching a website, and the website address is www.bbc.co.uk/mystory. and that has all the information on the terms and conditions of the competition, tips and hints on how to write your story. So if you do lack confidence and you want some help, you can find some information on the website, or you can go along to your nearest UK online centre, and again, they will help you.
So lots of help then?
Yeah, the help's there because, as I've said, I think it's important that we encourage everybody to be involved in this project. We don't just want people that go to creative writing shops or, you know, lessons to get involved with this. We want everybody to get involved because I really, really believe that everybody has a story to tell. I mean, I've been involved in radio and storytelling for years and years and years, so I like talking to people. And, you know, you could be at a bus stop and a complete stranger next to you, and within 5 minutes, they've given you these amazing stories. So people have these amazing stories, and most of them are untold. And all we're trying to say is, if you've got something that you want to tell us, please enter this project competition.
Has the BBC any idea how many stories they'd like to collect?
Well, numbers are always a big thing, aren't they? I suppose ideally we're looking sort of, hopefully, 100,000 stories would be fantastic. But I'm not working in numbers, really, because I think if you start working in numbers, you kind of detach yourself away from a project. It's important that we encourage people that maybe don't have confidence to come forward. We encourage people that maybe lack the skills to actually write their stories, to give them those skills and to give them that confidence to it. And also just get people involved in something. I mean, imagine if you write your story and your story then gets published onto the BBC website, anybody in the whole world can read that story. And I think it's just sharing those stories. It's just a real great snapshot of sort of current living in the 21st century today.
What's the closing date?
Okay, well, the competition launches mid-September and the closing date is the 16th of December. So there's plenty of time for people to think about the story that they want to write, maybe look at the resources that we have on the website. We are actually running workshops all over the country. Well, there are 6 workshops and there are a couple up north. And there will be roadshows happening all over the country. There are 6 happening within the next 6 weeks, and all the information is on the website. So to keep up to date with what's happening with My Story, if you just log on to the My Story website, you can find all the information there.
That was Anthea Page talking to Deborah Hearn. The website for the My Story competition is www.bbc.co.uk/My Story. And now an article from Tony Gosling about the University of Witherwood. At the end of September and beginning of October, students arrive for another year of studies at Bristol's 3 universities, yes, 3, the University West of England, Bristol University and the University of Witherwood. Bristol's smallest university receives no government money. In fact, it raises money to help educate children in parts of the world where there is little or no education. Their philosophy in the prospectus is to concentrate on all the fun aspects of learning and to dispense with all the disagreeable ones. The University of Witherwood was started by retired history teacher Anton Bandock, MBE, and he spoke to Dialect's Tony Gosling during the summer break about the unorthodox teaching methods he used while he was still a secondary school teacher.
History is wonderfully rich in human anecdote and story, and children, adults, people generally love a story. And the modern trend, unfortunately, has been away from that. It's been into cause and effect and economic and social history. Okay, that has its place, of course it has. But to really grab the interest of youngsters who don't have any special interest in schooling, well, you pull out all the stops and give them a really gory story. One is not supposed always to sort of rub in the violence and the cruelty, but it has its lessons. And fortunately, I have an ability to tell a story and also to illustrate it. And in the early days, before photocopiers and that sort of thing, I would draw pictures on the blackboard of the thing that I was doing, whether it was the Battle of Waterloo or Anne Boleyn having her head cut off. I'd draw a picture on the blackboard. And then, of course, in the days of Elms and Gestetner's stencils, I would make crude drawings, which then could be run off by the poor woman in the office. And in fact, the whole story of reproducing visual aids for classrooms I could give talks on that now, of how that's developed into things like this. You see this beautiful colour laser photocopier, which, of course, I never had in school, but I did at the end of my time in school. We did have a technician and photocopiers, and I reached the point where I was producing for every child, for every lesson, an amusing and also slightly instructive caricature or cartoon style drawing of the lesson that we were doing. So whether it was King John and Magna Carta, or whether it was Henry VIII's wives, or the career of Napoleon, there was always a picture which could then be processed. In other words, I tell the story. They had the picture in front of them. There were things to do. There were questions. There were things to fill in and label. And if they couldn't write, and they couldn't read, at least they could see that, read the picture, and they could colour it. They could even make paper aeroplanes out of it and throw it around the classroom, which, of course, broke my heart sometimes. But at its best, that system worked extremely well, and there were children who took a great pride in collecting these diagrams, colouring them, labelling them, putting them into a ring folder, and having the ring folder then judged by me and rewarded. I never, ever gave any other mark except 17 out of 20, 18 out of 20, 19 out of 20, or 20 out of 20, nothing less. Yes, sometimes I would give 5 or 2 out of 20, and then it was an absolute disgrace, and then I would have to do the whole thing again. So the whole of the marking system ran completely counter against all accepted policy in schools. The marking system was to encourage children, and they did compete to get their highest marks. So, you want some examples? Let me tell you one. And, of course, these are the things that really made teaching worthwhile for me. I thought, well, how do you get across to children exactly what Magna Carta was all about? So there's a picture, right, King John and the barons and one or two churchmen and a horse or two and a dog and a table under a tent and long grass and the river in the background. And then I would take them through just one or two points, like, you can't really expect to rule a country if you don't get the consent of the people to the amount of money they have to pay in tax. And it's not really fair to punish people and send them to prison unless they're given a chance to defend themselves. So, a fair trial. So, one or two little points like that, they could understand. And I thought, well, to drive the message home, accompany the drawing with a little kind of dialogue, and I drew the lines and written at the end of each line what the chief baron, Stephen Langton, or the archbishop, might say to the king, and what the king, and of course I'd already explained the King John was really rather sort of a difficult, recalcitrant sort of person who didn't really want to do anything much, what he might say in reply, and then what the second baron might say, and so on. About 10 lines. I said, now write a little play about a possible conversation that might happen over these points that the king was being asked to agree to. And I should think 9 times out of 10 that worked. And they got the message and they were able to do something. I remember one child putting up its hand, a little boy, Christian Millward his name was. He said, please, I'm having trouble with my play. So I went and had a look. And he'd written down for King John, my budgerigar's dead, how's yours? I used to read them the letters that Henry VIII wrote to Anne Boleyn while he was courting her. And sometimes, you know, if I was a little bit unprepared, things slipped out, which I ought not have read to children. I'm going to try to edit it as you read, but I mean, this thing slipped out. I can't wait to see your sweet duckies. Oh, so what's a sweet ducky? So I quickly gloss over that. Then the picture they have shows Anne Boleyn kneeling in front of the block. I mean, she knelt up. She didn't put her head on the block. She was beheaded with a sword. So a French swordman was brought in with this enormous great sword, and it shows the executioner taking a swipe and the head flying into the air. And, of course, the children go to town with their red felt tips. I said, right, now, you've got to put onto this diagram some comment. You can draw a balloon saying what maybe the Queen might have said before her execution, or what the executioner was saying, or even what they were thinking. And, of course, I'd already told them that Anne Boleyn had six fingers on one hand, because children remember things like that, and that her real words to the executioner was, treat me lightly, I have such a small neck. So one child had written in the balloon, I have a small neck, but I've got sweet tuckies. Goodness me, what the parents made of this! Well, I don't know what how my career ended. I think probably I'd got to a point where I couldn't be assailed by infuriated headmasters and deputy heads who sometimes took me to task for having delivered things in lesson time, which, of course, the parents loved it. They would ask for more, you know. They wanted the love life of Mussolini. I started serialising the love life of Mussolini with the fifth form. It got into the hands of the deputy head, who said, well, we can't have this sort of thing in a classroom. I said, well, I've been asked by several parents for the next instalment. So, anyway,
Do you think there's a conflict then sometimes between the way that schools are run and the way that parents that would like them to be run?
Yes. I mean, I was unorthodox, and I survived in that school. It's terribly sad, and it's a bit disloyal of me to say this, but I got the feeling that I didn't get support from the so-called hierarchy, the administration. Nowadays, I mean, I was amazed. I've been into schools recently, and there are as many counsellors to children as there are teachers, and maybe they're more counsellors. In other words, if you've got a problem child, that is cared for by a special person brought in. You know, the child is taken out and so on. So you can teach. But I don't know, when I was there, you have to deal with all your problem ones as well. And you got very little support from the so-called hierarchy. The only times that I was actually taken to task and brought down to the office and told, oh no, you haven't been firm enough, Mr. Bantock, and you can't allow children to use these four-letter words. I said, you haven't got a clue as to what's happening in these classrooms. Oh no, of course they can't admit it publicly because our school is a better image. I remember going back to my classroom to sometimes quite a rowdy class and thinking, well, these are my allies. These are my companions. It's not the teachers who are supposed to be supporting me. It's the class, and here I feel at home. And I thought, well, they can get on with their little bits of paper and their meetings. Let me get on with what's important, and that is relating to children and making life a little bit more interesting for them. So, yes, I remember once being sent. This, I don't think it happens nowadays. If a teacher falls sick and doesn't come in, well, of course, there's supposed to be cover. And nowadays, of course, there's supply teachers there all the time to step in and look after. Not in the old days. I mean, you valued your free periods, but, I mean, you very often lost them because somebody else's class had to be covered. I remember once being suddenly sent, at short notice, into a chemistry laboratory, third-year class. And I arrived, and there was absolute pandemonium. No work had been set. Water was being squirted all over the place. The Bunsen burners were on. The gas was leaking out. I thought, this requires absolutely drastic action. So I said, right, we're going to have a drawing competition. I said, there's going to be a money prize. And, of course, children, you're not supposed to do this with children. I said, there's going to be a money prize. Here is your piece of paper, are you going to be a money prize for the best picture of Queen Victoria's bottom? Of course, the children are absolutely electrified. I didn't specify whether the bottom should be closed or unclosed. Anyway, silence reigned, and the children were drawing Queen Victoria's bottom. As to what was coming out of the bottom and going into the bottom is nobody's business. And the little boy who won the prize did a picture of Queen Victoria bent double, back view. And you could see her head looking between her legs, and an imperial crown perched on the top of the bum. It was beautiful, and this boy won the prize. I mean, some of the pictures, I still kept them because they're hilarious. I mean, there was tattoos on the bum, there was elastoplast, there were great gashes and marks and rashes and warts and pimples. Oh, my God. I think it was after that the headmaster came to me and said, don't you think you should be thinking of early retirement, Mr. Bannon? No, it wasn't that. It was something else much worse, I think, that caused them to say that. But they put pressure on me after the age of 49 because Avon, as it then was, had far too many teachers. So they put pressure on everyone over 49 to go and have a golden handshake and get out. And I resisted that for 5 years. I thought, I'm still at the top of my form. I've got a lot to give. But in the end, age 54... I said, all right, I'll go. I regret it, really. I think had I been in a private school, a grammar school, public school, I should have been in longer. And I suppose the University of Witherwood was, in a sense, a continuation of what I was doing at school. And I had all these resources, which I continued to use with the material that used to come here and still comes. And so the transition was relatively painless.
The unorthodox teaching methods of former history teacher Anton Bandock, there who was the founder of Bristol's third and smallest university. Their autumn term programme is now available and it starts in the second week in October. Classes include the arts class, Witherwood Whistler, Don Townsend's performing arts group, Spanish conversation Wednesday mornings, German conversation, French conversation twice a week, and a visiting speaker every Thursday evening where all students can attend. Contact University of Witherwood on 0117 9641 666. And you can find out more on the website at www.universityofwitherwood.org.uk. We'll have the second part of this interview with Anton Bandock next week. For £5 a year, they will post you regular updates on new terms, courses, etc.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And it's that time of the week again. It's the time for Jeff Sparks' weekly What's On Guide.
Good evening, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 2nd of October, Daniel and Merryweather will be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and tickets are £13.50 in advance. Also on 2nd of October, The Infirm will be performing at the Racehorse in Wellbrook Street, which is in Tiverton, Devon. The gig starts at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to Song of the Week and our feature at Motorhead. This is from the album Overnight Sensation, which was released in 1996, and is a track titled Listen to Your Heart. Thanks. That was Motorhead with Listen to Your Heart from the album Overnight Sensation. For more information on them, you can check out www.imotorhead.com. Also, they're on a UK tour starting on November the 11th with support from The Damned and also Girls' School. Moving on to Saturday, the 3rd of October, the Travelling Band will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £4 in advance. Also on 3rd of October, Gentlemen's Dub Club will be performing with support from King Porter Stomp at Fiddler's in Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £8 in advance. And finally, on the 3rd of October, John E. Vistic Experience will be performing with support from Ten Tongue Tongue and also Groove Grinder at Area 81 in Bristol. Doors open at 9pm and entry is £5 on the door. On to the 4th of October, A Day at the Races will be performing with support from On Off Switch, Kilimanjaro, Guiltless Adam and A Quince Tale. Doors open at 6pm and tickets are £5 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff Sparks. Well, that's the end of another week's Dialect Show. Studio guests were Andrew Baisley and Alistair Park. The Innkeeper's Diary was read by Malcolm Greaves. The feature was by Anthea Page. What's On Guide was by Jeff Sparks. The studio engineer was Mark Condon. And assistant engineer was Johnny Royden. It's goodbye from me, Lisa Braden, presenter of this week's Dialect Radio. Oh, 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 oh